Hello, Millennium Live listeners. It is great to be back for another episode. I hope your week is going as good as mine, and we're happy to be back for another episode. Excited to see what the future holds, not only to have our members come on, but to have our partners talk about the success that they're having and the overall value that they're bringing to the industry with multiple topics and multiple industries that Millennium Alliance does. Today, we're going to be focused on cybersecurity and specifically managing cloud risks on a budget. I have a great guest. He's a podcast veteran, so certainly a veteran in cybersecurity and in cloud. He is Andy Ellis. Loads of experience, author, Hall of Fame CSO. I can't wait to maybe even chat a little bit about yourself, Andy, to start. But, you know, you're a visionary technologist and executive. You have a deep understanding of security, managing risks, and leading inclusive culture. Today, we're going to be talking a lot about those things and why it's important to industry-leading enterprises to have good cloud security.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're going to dive into a lot of different aspects of cloud security and sort of the ways that organizations can dive into and approach this strategically on a budget. So starting off in a strategic approach, you know, first of all, based on your expertise in cybersecurity and in this space, you know, what have you seen out there? You know, how can organizations really develop a strategic approach to managing cloud risks that align with their overall business objectives, but keeping in mind that some may be working on a limited budget?
Yeah. So I think the answer is almost in the question there, which is, what are your business objectives? I think a lot of times people say, oh, I need to secure the cloud, and they don't say, for what purpose? So let's start with the what purpose. You know, is your company cloud native? Is everything you're doing in the cloud? Or maybe you're not. Maybe you're testing out cloud. Maybe for you, cloud is really just SaaS. I've run into this before where you get to somebody and you're talking all about cloud security. And at the very end, they're like, oh yeah, and I'm worried about Zoom. And you're like, okay, that's not the same cloud thing as the rest of us are talking about. So first is like, figure out what cloud means for your business and like, how amazing will it be or how dangerous is it? So I'm a huge fan of Nancy Levison. If your listeners haven't, you know, heard of her, that's okay. She's a professor of software security at MIT, but she really wrote the safety approach to system design. So I've got her book behind me, not that we're on video. It's Engineering a Safer World. And it really talks about when you're trying to build safe systems, which security is a subset of safety in some worlds, you first start by saying, what are the unacceptable losses? And if you want to talk about business objectives, like that's the first place you start, is you say, well, what could go wrong? Not how does it go wrong, but what's the end state outcome? So if you say, oh, we could breach all of our user data, like that's an unacceptable loss. Okay, well, is all of our user data in the cloud or not? Because if it is in the cloud, now it lets us start to say, well, now we have to tackle that. But maybe it's not there, in which case, you know, over-focusing on, you know, privacy and data security, you know, might not be the place to put your limited budget. Much as I would like to say you should always focus on data security, like if your cloud use is like mine, like personally, you know, I run a couple of small petty websites. They're all just marketing websites run out of AWS. There's very little data security issues there. So it would be foolish for me to be focused heavily on, oh, how do I encrypt everything within my limited spare time?
I want to dive into some of the key risk factors that organizations should prioritize. And when it comes to securing their cloud environments, how can some of the key risks that you know be mitigated effectively within those budget constraints that we're talking about?
So once you've identified your unacceptable losses, like what are the bad outcomes, now you want to shift into those risk factors, or what I like to say is the hazards, right? Think of these as you're walking down the road, and if there's a pothole, that's a hazard, right? It's a risk factor that if you're not paying attention, trips you up, you fall on your face, unacceptable loss. And so you should always just sort of have a, like, here's a set of hazards I know I'm going to go look at, like, you know, data breaches, you know, misconfigurations, like, oh, unauthorized access. Well, what does unauthorized access mean? Well, one issue is I have passwords that might get breached. Maybe I shouldn't be using passwords, or I might have accounts with, you know, overly broad permissions that when breached move, right? Data breaches. Oh, I have data that's not encrypted at rest, or that's, you know, being replicated all over my environment. So you start to sort of take all of these risk factors, you know, patch management, and you put them together. And I like creating attack paths where you say, okay, given some adversary who only has the powers of an internet connection and a Linux box, right? They've installed maybe Metasploit on it. What harm can they do to me, right? Well, they don't have a direct access to my database, but they could connect to a web server that isn't patched. Okay, once they've done that and they compromise that web server, now they have a new power. They're inside my cloud environment on a machine that might have identities. Okay, can they use those identities to move further in? So you build this attack path. And what you'll discover over time is that these attack paths have a lot of common hazards in them. It's the same thing. It's like, oh, when we set up our environment, we only had one user account. So that user account, like its credentials are on every machine and has access to everything. Okay, maybe clean that up because that's the hazard that is common across all of your scenarios.
Andy, you are the advisory CISO at Orca Security.
Yep.
So you might know a thing or two about solutions and providers of technology. So what are some of the cost-effective solutions that are out there and best practices for securing cloud infrastructure without compromising security standards?
Yeah, so I think you're often looking at sort of three completely different approaches, right? So one approach is do it all yourself. I don't generally recommend that unless you have a really big security team where you're really going to grow things up and it includes a software engineering practice. But very few people have the scale to afford to do it themselves and make that cost effective. In the middle is cobble things together. And that's actually a great place to start. I'm a big fan of taking, you know, anybody in your security team and say, hey, go look at the native tools that our environment provides. Like if you're in AWS or GCP or Azure, there's a lot of cloud security tools that they give you that are really good technical point solutions that require a lot of human work around them to integrate. But that human work can be a fascinating way for your developers and your security engineers to learn, like, oh, like I can get this great data feed, but now I have to build all my integrations to everything else. Right. And on the far side is, can you find something that's already done all that integration for you? I think one of the most famous examples of a company who did this, not in the cloud security space, but in the inventory management space, was Exonius, who basically their claim to fame was they were the best API integrator out there. And whatever systems that you had that had some inventory somewhere, Exonius would put it all in one place for you. Like, and that was huge. And so we see that in it's called the Cloud Native Application Protection Platform space, CNAPP. And CNAPPs basically do this. It's okay, we connect and we look at all of your configurations, right? How have you configured these systems? We're going to rebuild images off of the, snapshots taken so we can say what's actually running on a platform, where are the keys, we're going to build the database across all of these. And the idea is, rather than spending your time chasing down integrations, you spend your time looking through these sort of prioritized attack paths to say, what's the critical things I need to deal with right now? And then once you've dealt with the most critical, now how do I build missions to improve my security? Because that's sort of the two axes you want to spend your energy on. Like, what are the things that, if it's not an incident today, it's probably going to be one tomorrow. Let's get that dealt with. But once I've done that, like, how do I actually, get above the weeds and say, oh, if I fix this one problem, I solve actually 1,000 different scenarios, right? And that's really what you want to go after as you're building things. And then have in the automation to make sure, and the monitoring, to make sure you don't backslide. Biggest security challenge almost everybody has is we spend a lot of human energy to go fix a bunch of problems, and then we think it's okay, so we turn away and go work on a different thing and come back 3 years later and discover that because we didn't implement automated monitoring, like, oh, nope, nobody was still doing the thing we told them to do.
That leads me right to the next question. Is it focused more on employee training? And given the fact that human error is a significant factor in security incidents, how can organizations implement effective and budget-friendly employee training programs that are enhancing cloud security awareness?
I love Nancy Levison's quote on this. I'm going to quote her one more time. She says, human error is a symptom of a system in need of redesign. That's where it starts from. Most security awareness programs are, we have a bad system, and because we have this bad system, humans doing their normal thing will cause us outages. And so we're going to tell you not to do your normal thing anymore. Like the most famous one is, don't click stuff in email. To which I say, like, have you ever been employed by a company? The first thing you have to do is click like 20 things in email if you ever want to get paid. So telling employees not to click things isn't going to work so well. So you really need to marry your awareness program to your design program. And say, what behaviors do we want people to do? How do we figure out how to design systems to make those behaviors safe, and then tell you like how to work around it? So as an example for the phishing one, you know, we used to basically go after anybody in the company who could send email to the whole company. And we said, if you're ever going to send out, have email come from a third party, you have to send mail first under your own account. So head of HR, you will send out email before the third party sends out a survey. Like, no surprises here, because we want to be able to tell people that if you get a link that is suspicious, you get to come complain about it. And it was our fault if we didn't send out that notice first, right? It's not a, we're going to trust you to get every single link right. We're going to try to build a better process. And that's what you need to do with your developers, is you're building systems. You know, how do you get the alerts about security problems right in front of the developers so they can deal with it, rather than having some, you know, security project manager chasing them down, who's really just copying and pasting out of a console and emailing it to a developer and saying, hey, can you fix this, with no context, right? So it's really, why are we doing this? What are the risks that we're trying to prevent? Like, if I can say, hey, developer, you think your system's not important, but by the way, it's sitting on the same network segment as your virtual network segment, I guess, in the cloud world, you know, as this sensitive data, either move your system or better secure it. Hey, now they've got a choice. I've given them an awareness moment. I've given them power, because that's important, is awareness should be tied to power for someone to make a change. Because if it's not, then they're just going to feel frustrated.
Managing security vendors. How can organizations ensure that robust security measures are in place when relying on third-party cloud service providers, especially, again, as we've been talking about, with that tighter budget? What are the priorities?
So I definitely think that this is one of the hardest things to do. So how do you evaluate your vendors? And there's an entire unsolved market in what's called third-party risk management. Like, how do I figure out which vendors are actually tall enough to play? Because here's the reality, is you can send a vendor a questionnaire and they're going to fill it out, and they all know to say yes to every question. Like, do you have a practice to do X? Of course I do, because if I say no, you're going to ask me more questions. And if I say yes, you won't follow up. You're not going to ask for evidence. So it's first, make sure somebody is tall enough to at least play that game. Because if they're not, then you probably do have a security issue of just, they've never holistically looked at their security program. They've never sold to a company who's at least as professional as you are. But the value you're going to get in reviewing their answers, not the sort of thing you should spend too much time on. And now there's a lot of services that will basically just assess those answers for you, and make it easier for you to say, hey, did they at least say yes to the right things? What I think you need to do is set up expectations with your vendors. And I like to start with the shared responsibility model here of saying, what are the ways that I can dangerously configure your service? How can I shoot myself in the foot because I don't know enough to use your service safely? And it's a great question, because first of all, it's not confrontational. You have not accused them of building an unsafe service. What you're doing is you're saying, I am not as clever as you are at using your service. What do I need to make sure I do? And if they say, oh, nothing, like, our service is completely safe, that should be a big red flag, right? They should come back and they say, oh, well, here's things you should do. Like, maybe you need to have an admin and non-admins. Maybe you need to configure certain things in certain ways. And that's really what you want to look at, is the vendors who have hit that level of maturity are going to tell you that, like, these are the people you probably want to work with. And then the other thing you should always do is you should recognize that all of your vendors are going to have bad days at some point in the future. What do you want to do about it? Sometimes that means you're going to look for another vendor. Sometimes that means you're going to bear with it, but you want to have a conversation with them. Like, whatever it's going to be, that's how you really want to think about your vendors.
Before we start talking about some of the cool tools that are probably noteworthy or that you recommend, in the event of security incidents, you know, what steps should organizations with budget constraints take to develop and implement an effective incident response plan that you're talking about for their cloud environments?
So the first thing you should do is, right now, if you're a listener and you don't have an incident response plan, I want you to open up, whether it's a Google Doc or a SharePoint doc or whatever it's going to be, and just write incident response plan and put in it, number one, do something. Okay, you now have an incident response plan. It's a bad one. But here's what's key. When you have incident response plans, every time you exercise it, you're going to learn and figure out, oh, I need to do different things. By creating the document, when you have an incident response, you're going to be going through that and be like, start adding it and populating it. Like, here's what I need to do specifically for me. But you should start figuring it out now. Like, oh, every time I have to troubleshoot, let's start putting in that document the troubleshooting steps. Like, oh, I need to get access to this thing, and so-and-so has the permissions to give me access. Write that down now so that when you need to do it in real time, you're good. So you're starting to build this sort of clear, actionable incident response plan. Like, what are you going to do? Right? Do some drills and simulations. Like, go test this. You know, and most environments will basically give you cause to test your incident response plan. Take a minor issue, but run it through a rigorous incident response plan to see what works, what doesn't work. Right? Know who your team is, who's in charge. Biggest challenge I see a lot of companies do is they try to do decisions by committee. Like, you have a couple technologists, a couple business people, and they're trying to debate what to do. And meanwhile, you've got somebody with fingers on a keyboard who's like, can I press return? Like, can I just do this? So figure out who's in charge of making those decisions. Lastly, you know, and this is a, you know, for a lot of companies, they don't think about how they're going to communicate with the public. And you really need to do that. And the most important thing is to recognize that you don't get to have an ego when you talk with the public. And, you know, specifically, I saw a company just, in fact, wrote a newsletter about this. I have a leadership newsletter on the side. I think Carta recently had an issue where they got in trouble, you know, for, you know, some interesting business practices, and their apology note that their CEO puts out then turns around and yells at the customer who brought this up and like blames them for things they had said during it. I'm like, man, you just needed to take your ego right out of that. It's a key piece of incident response planning that most people forget, which is you're hyped up on adrenaline and now you always have to take the high road because you were the one who failed.
If they have their document open, would you recommend typing in a ChatGPT incident response plan?
Give me 10. Absolutely. Like, type into ChatGPT and say, what are the elements of a cloud security incident response plan? And don't assume it's complete, but it's always a great start.
Continuing on with this conversation, and I definitely want to get into the tools, compliance. Andy, you know, what are specific open source security tools that you recommend for organizations at least taking a look at to enhance their cloud security posture without, you know, breaking the bank?
You know, I think there's tools like, you know, OSSim and OpenVAS, you know, Mod Security, which now has a new home, which is fantastic to hear. You know, there's a lot of different things you can start to look at. What I think is really important you should do before you implement one of these tools is go look for its community support. Because what makes an open source tool useful is the community that's going to help teach you how to use this. Because you're not getting support from a vendor. So your support is like, how do other people set this up? And if, you know, they've got entire forums just dedicated to like doing the install and almost no forums dedicated to using this in practice, maybe this isn't the one for you. So that's really where I would start. So is start taking a look at that, and then do the same thing even for things that aren't open source but are free or bundled in with your existing product offering. So if you're in AWS, there's a bunch of security tools you can just take advantage of in AWS. Go find the communities that will support you and sort of teach you how to do that, because you're not going to get that high vendor touch that's going to make sure you're getting value for the dollar you spent.
Just kind of moving on to compliance.
Yep.
You know, many industries have stringent compliance requirements. When we're talking about, again, budget limitations, how can organizations ensure compliance is met, especially with industry standards that are high in the cloud?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to understand not just your industry, but your customers' industries, right? Because if you're building in the cloud, odds are you're not selling to end users. You know, there are a lot of people who do, but a lot of people are selling to other businesses. And so, oh, you want to go sell to financial services, then you've got to be familiar with NYDFS so that you're not going to get in trouble in New York. Or you want to sell to the government, so you need FedRAMP. So you should almost always start with SOC 2. Like, that's just sort of the easiest place to begin, is a SOC 2, you know, against one of the NIST standards, get you to a reasonable level of security. And that's going to sort of let you communicate a baseline to your customers that says, hey, here's where we are. But now you have to put it into their language by industry. So, oh, you're going to go into healthcare, so you need to be able to talk HIPAA and high tech and use the language that they're going to expect. The way I like to think about compliance is that in a well-run security program, compliance is typesetting, right? It's like you've written this book about security, and now you just have to like translate it and typeset it so that it's pretty, it's easy to understand. Because if an auditor can like look at this and they're like, oh, look, everything is like in the same format and everything's pretty, they're much less likely to look at you askance than if you hand them like, you know, crayon diagrams of, you know, what's going on. They'll be like, oh, maybe these people are a little bit skeptical, or I should be skeptical of these people. So that's really where I start. So think about what are the security fundamentals that meet the compliance requirements rather than just building something for a compliance need. Because the challenge of doing it exactly just to fit a compliance requirement is that when you shift to a different compliance regime and they phrase it differently, you're not coming from a fundamental security. You were coming from a, oh, we implemented it this way just because like that auditor asked for it that way. And now we can't apply the same security control somewhere else.
So, Andy, what methodologies and frameworks do you recommend for conducting regular risk assessments in the cloud? And how can organizations integrate these into their security practices?
There's a lot of different ways to do it, right? There's the, you know, NIST cloud security, you know, the CSF. I'm actually a big fan of, you know, Sunil Yu's Cyber Defense Matrix. There's a way to approach it. You can use a risk assessment, you know, something like out of the ISO 27000 series, you know, where it's just like, here's all the different controls, let's go check on them. But what I think is really important is you should understand that when you're assessing risk, you're going to have risks that are immediate, urgent, and I just got to go solve them. Like, this should not be, you shouldn't be thinking about that as a risk assessment problem. If you find it when doing risk assessment, like, you should stop and go solve the problem. Like, those are what incidents, like, I get a lot of value out of doing this, and it's not actually a hard thing to go fix. Like, oh, I have a like open port that's unauthenticated on my main database, public to the world. I don't need to assess risk at that point. Like, I know that I just need to go close that port down. You know, maybe I'm going to firewall it, put on authentication, but go solve it. You know, so think about that as one level of risk assessment is things you find and you just deal with, and you don't try to prioritize them against other work. They just need to happen. You know, at the other far end of the spectrum is the stuff that the risk assessment methodology is often too heavily weighted for, because the things that are very low value, but, you know, also sort of a low cost to go do. So think of that as like, you know, just standard, you know, bugs that you would fix. This is one of the reasons I love the Common Vulnerability Scoring System for vulnerabilities. It's actually a pretty light way to score vulnerabilities and let you say, yep, this one should be fixed, but it's like a 4.0. If it takes a while, it's okay, but we don't want to waste our energy arguing over it because we don't want to spend more time than it will take to fix this in that argument. So those are like, that's great for the things that are easy to fix. Now, what about the things that are hard to fix? There's things that are hard to fix and don't provide a lot of value, or your business has decided to accept them. I like to call these things like the truck bomb scenario. Like, if you have a headquarters building somewhere, which less, fewer and fewer companies have in the post-COVID days, but like, somebody could drive up a truck bomb and blow up your building. Okay, that's a risk that mitigating that is hard. Like, you would have to basically redesign, have a corporate campus somewhere far away from a city, security guards far outside, like not let, you know, vehicles in without heavy security. There are places that do that. We call them like the Pentagon and the NSA. But for most companies, that's impractical. And you're really not gonna try to solve for that risk. And so, great, have a way to assess risks as just being, yep, they're environmental hazards that we're going to accept. And now focus your risk assessment methodology on what's left, which is the things that are hard to fix but have high value, you know, architectural flaws in our systems. Oh, we need to put in place an identity and entitlements management system for the cloud. You know, what's the hard work there? Or can we make it easy? And this is a place where I think we've seen huge changes recently. Is like 6 years ago, if you said, you know, I want to control all my cloud entitlements, and if anybody's never done this, it is brutal to do. Like, you don't have good role-based rules that are set up. You often have to do things very manually among different groups. And nobody would do it because you have like thousands and thousands of rules you have to set up. It turns out that often there's like 6 or 7 quick changes you can make that automation will help you identify that'll, you know, solve 80% of the problem for you. So you take this really big, hairy problem and you shift it, saying instead of there's a lot of work to get a lot of value, there's like 10% of the work to get 90% of the value. Let's do that. And then the 90% of the work to get the last 10% of the value, well, let's not do that. Put that back into our hazard category. And so that's where the risk assessment really sort of shows up. You say, like, how do we compare these? How do we talk about these? I'm a huge fan of using as simple and as human language as possible. There's a lot of risk assessment methodologies that try to get into putting dollars on risks, and then people can argue about, like, is this really a $40 million risk or is this really a $2 million risk? And at the end of the day, those numbers are made up. So just talk about, like, how bad is the outcome and how surprising would it be if this happened? Like, really simple And if two things have the same things, that's okay. If you've got 20 good things to do work on, then doing work on one of them is better than doing work on none of them.
I could probably sit here and chat with you all day about cloud security, but I do want to end the podcast with a question about looking ahead towards the future.
Yep.
And what do you see in terms of cloud security, Andy? What do you think that are some of the trends that organizations should be aware of going forward this year and on to the next? And how can they best prepare for these trends?
So I think the biggest trend we're going to see is, first of all, cloud is more rather than less. Like, everybody is moving things more and more to cloud. So this is not a flash in the pan, the environment's going away. What we're seeing on the cloud security side is increased sort of leverage of machine learning, even AI technologies, you know, like writing remediation instructions by having ChatGPT do it, like, is a huge step up. Because often what companies have done is they hand it to very low cost writer, you know, developers, you know, who English is a second language, and you ask them to write remediation instructions, ask ChatGPT to do it. Like, that's become a huge standard. And now, like, every cloud security company has a better interface for people to interact with. It's just easier to talk to. But at the same time, using machine learning to find these problems inside large data sets. Because the data is getting larger, the ability for someone to understand what their cloud environment actually looks like is getting harder and harder, because it's no longer the simple, like, three-tiered network-based architecture. You know, it's microservices all over the place, systems talking to one another. And unless you have the ability to have an automated system that can look across all of that, then you're going to be left in the weeds.
Andy Ellis, advisory CISO at Orca Security. I want to thank you, Andy, for your time, especially coming on the show, talking about managing cloud risks. You know, you're a great guest for the podcast. And if you haven't yet done a podcast interview with Nancy, I recommend that you do, because I'd be one of the first ones to listen to it. I'm sure our audience would love that, too, because I think
a great idea. I love that.
It would be a great conversation. But thank you, Andy, for joining the Millennium Live podcast. And we'll see you soon for an assembly.
Thanks for having me.